8-1 to advance to the IIA state tournament next week in Grand Chute. Stanley Cup Finals, Game 4 tonight in Chicago. Tampa Bay leads the series 2-1. Game 5 will be Saturday in Tampa Bay. In the NBA Championship Series, Game 3 last night, Cleveland beat Golden State 96-91. Cavs are now up 2-1. Game 4 will be Thursday in Cleveland. Now the WGTD forecast from the National Weather Service for this Wednesday, June 10th. Partly cloudy, slight chance of rain this morning, then becoming sunny and hot for the afternoon, a high today of 88. Perspective on that number, normal high this time of year would be 74. The record high was 97 degrees, June 10th, 1911. Right now, we have 75 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha, 72 for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Wind from the west at 16, gusting to 22. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 11 minutes after 8, the morning show with Greg Berg up next. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. And support also comes from Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergrad and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu.
I am so happy to be sitting across the table for today's morning show from someone who is very, very familiar to many of you, Linda Fleshinsky. I'm sure many of you have enjoyed the work that she has done over the air for WGTD. For a while, she was one of our set of rotating hosts of Education Matters, and currently you hear her most often with a recurring program called Heroes in Our Midst, in which Linda sits down and interviews people who in one way or another have really demonstrated exceptional courage in the face of various challenges, or who have gone on to accomplish some important things and important accomplishments which required courage of one kind or another. She for many years worked for the Racine Unified School District. And also, many of you surely know Linda Fleshinsky for the really fine writing which she has done chiefly for the Racine Journal-Times, and in particular a column which ran in the Journal-Times for many, many years called In What Light There Is. I'm really happy to report that Linda Fleshinsky has gathered together some of her really finest columns together in a book which is of that same name, In What Light There Is. And sometimes when somebody you know writes a book, you sort of grit your teeth and hope you'll like it. And so often those kind of efforts, while maybe well-meaning and earnest efforts, are on some level artistically or professionally kind of disappointing. Not in this case, not in the least. Linda's writing is absolutely first rate. But beyond the really polished, elegant writing here is also a great deal of heart as she makes observations about her life, her family, the world around her, some of the important issues which confront us, and often looking at the world through not just a wise eye, but also the eye of humor and bemusement after experiencing a whole lot of different things in her life. Again, the book is called In What Light There Is. And Linda Fleshinsky, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, my gosh, Greg, what a wonderful intro. Thank you so much. I just feel so lucky to be here being interviewed on the other side of the microphone.
Well, I was just going to say, this is probably an odd sensation. I've very seldom been on the other side of the microphone, and I suppose this is in some ways disconcerting, but hopefully it'll be fun for you.
Well, you know, a funny thing is I was director of communication for the school district, and so I was a lot of times I was interviewed in that position, but that was a lot of years ago, so I was like, oh, I'm going to be interviewed. Scary.
You have to have the answers now. Yeah. I wonder if you could say a word about the title of this book, which was also the title of your column in the Journal Times that I know so many people enjoyed, me included. Where does that title come from?
Thank you. Yes, that's from when my favorite writer poet in college was the author of that quote. He wrote a poem that ended, "Still, I see this world as worlds will be seen in what light there is." It's the late, great John Ciardi who wrote that. And I just, that phrase resonated with me, "Still, I see this world as worlds will be seen in what light there is." So I, on the inside cover, of course, I credit him. You don't have to necessarily, if you have like a world-famous quote that everybody knows to be or not to be, but I wanted people to know that's Ciardi's. But I think, you know, we're on this journey, and it's a complicated one, and sometimes it's so joyous, and sometimes it's so sorrowful. And I think we sort of muddle through in what light we have, how we ourselves can see this world. So I like that phrase enormously.
Right. It essentially is saying most of us do the best we can, whatever that happens to be, but he says it's so much more poetically.
He's like that with a lot of things. So.
Well, that's very good. Ahead of us talking about this book and specifically about your writing, say a word for our listeners about where you come from, where you grew up, and what was most important to you as you were growing up.
Sure. I was born in Green Bay. We lived there 6 months. I actually have a lot of relatives up in Green Bay. But 6 months later, my dad's job took us to Fond du Lac, and we were there till I was in about second grade. And we moved that year that I was in second grade to Madison. And I have, like so many people, a very deep affection for Madison. It was a wonderful place to grow up. Although I do have an essay in the book about Fond du Lac and the bats out by the cherry trees. That's what I remember at night flying around.
Well, and I'm grateful that that essay also tells us what Fond du Lac means, isn't it?
Far end of the lake.
Far end of the lake. I never knew that. So,
I grew up really in Madison, graduated from La Follette High School in Madison, and went on to college there. My parents partly moved when Dad had the opportunity with the Chicago Northwestern Railroad to move to Madison. And my parents partly chose that, even though they had a lot of friends in Fond du Lac, because they were middle-income people, and they wanted their kids to all go to college, four of us. And they knew if we were in town, we wouldn't have some of the expenses we would have other places. So it was a good choice, wonderful place to grow up and to go to college, and lovely.
I know that in one of your columns you talk about how you had this aspiration to go to medical school.
Yes.
And you write so poignantly about how various people in your life discouraged you from pursuing that. First of all, where do you think that interest came from? That is the aspiration to go to medical school. Can you point to anything that inspired that?
You know, I don't remember that, but what was so interesting to me is years later, my mom said to me, "You know, when you were little, you said you wanted to be a doctor, and somebody said, don't you mean a nurse?" And I said, "No, I want to be a doctor." So I guess I had it in me young, but I didn't focus on it until high school, and I went back to that and thought, you know, it's a good career. And now I have our oldest daughter is an MD, so as is her husband. But I think it must have been somewhere inside of me, and I'm glad you mentioned that column. It's called Just the Girl, and I feel like women my age, I'm in my late 60s, they really have lived through this. And I write in that column about how my husband at Johnson Wax they were asked to go to a gender sensitivity. They all had to do that. And he was so surprised at the women who sat there and cried, actually tears running down their eyes, because their brothers could go to college. But they didn't need to, because they were just going to get married and have children anyway.
Wow.
And all the stories that they told about the opportunities that were lost to them. And it wasn't just something like, you know, medical school, which would have been a great career and paid well. But it's if they wanted to be a firefighter, you know, there were just all kinds of fields, police officer, that it was very, very hard. And we remember those years well. I can't remember. Someone wrote a book a few years back, a pretty big book, and maybe her name will come to me, but about how difficult it was for women those years. And it wasn't that women were put down in the way that African Americans were for jobs and everything else. But it still stings with a lot of us.
Sure. Well, and one of the things you share in that column, which I find so striking, is that, you know, it wasn't just your, you know, 88-year-old grandfather in a rocking chair, you know, spouting his kind of antique wisdom about how he saw the world. But one of the first people who really made a concerted effort to discourage this interest of yours was your guidance counselor in your high school. I mean, of all people, for somebody entrusted with that
Absolutely.
Kind of responsibility, I can, and
Absolutely.
As you write about that, we can sense even to this day sort of your disbelief that,
uh-huh.
that someone like that would be offering advice of that nature.
Yes. And, I mean, they admired me. They gave me a scholarship that paid my tuition all the way for 4 years. Not that back then our tuition was nothing compared to now. But it was disheartening. And, you know, I learned something about prejudice on sort of a bigger scale from those experiences, is that sometimes it's very, very subtle, and it's said in a way that is heartfelt from people. You know, if you, what if you want to get married and have children? And, you know, I babysat for the 4 children of a doctor and his wife, and he said that. He said, I don't like that, you know, women get these degrees and then they don't use them. Well, I don't think that that's true. I don't think women, especially back then, having to fight so hard to make it happen. Now medical schools are 50% women or more or less, but around that rate. And my daughter has a wonderful career, and she has 3 children, and she has a wonderful life. And, you know, it actually, I think, fits in better with a woman with a career and children than many other careers where you have to be there 8 to 5. There's some flexibility that physicians would have that others don't.
Absolutely. I also appreciate in that column how you help us understand, and you were kind of making this point earlier, that in some ways it's a little dangerous to use a word like discrimination to describe what you experienced. If you don't mind me reading
Not
just
at
this
all.
Little moment, you write, I would never have used the discrimination word back then for what I experienced. Women were, after all, spoken of in the most generous of terms. We were the adored girlfriends, the beloved mothers, the gentle grandmothers of our time. Now I see, though, that even that was touched with discrimination, laced with prejudice, full of booby traps. A recent book spoke of the need for women to be afforded care and protection, as if it is only women who need those things. I think you're making such a good point that it can be couched in very affectionate and even what seems like affirming terms.
Yep.
And yet when you really examine it closely, there's something really ominous going on there.
And, you know, it harkens back to, maybe far a comparison, but in some ways it isn't. When there was slavery, the slave owners would say they need our protection. They're not able, it's too strenuous for them to learn how to read or, I mean, obviously.
Or to be on their own.
Right.
And, yeah.
And I don't, you know, blame myself in that book, but in some ways there were women my age who just did it anyway.
Right.
I think I was too influenced by those negative voices and, and they weren't even, they were gently negative voices, but
well,
I still heard them.
Sure. Well, in fact, you mentioned at one point in that column about the tepid response of your parents
yes.
to this idea of you going to medical school. So they obviously hadn't vetoed it, but weren't excited. And that, you know, for someone maybe of your personality, that was a little
too. It was enough. Yeah.
Right.
We were very close with our parents, and they did want all their children to go to college, and they wanted them all to get degrees that they could use. And it's just back then that was for women, that was teaching or being a nurse.
Yeah.
That was about it.
This conversation brings to mind another amazing moment in this book, and I don't remember now. You can maybe remember or tell me the title of this essay, but it talks about when you went to college, and that very early on, you and all of the other female students, as part of physical education class,
yes.
were photographed naked, supposedly to, or officially, as a study of posture or something like that. But here you were, each and every one of you. Do you remember what column that is? Or what it's?
I'm trying to remember what it was called, because I was trying to make a bigger point about speaking up. But
yeah.
But yes, I'll tell you about that, because that is so amazing. I had a friend read, some people read the book before I sent it off, and she wrote next to that one, "No one will ever believe this." And my experience with that was so interesting.
And by the way, it's called Speaking Up. I just found it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Speaking Up, it's called. And for years, I never told anybody that, and we were, I don't know, maybe 15 years ago at a Thanksgiving at our dinner at my brother's house. And I think I brought it up. And my sister said, "You were?" She said, "I was too." She also went to UW-Madison. So I thought it was a UW-Madison thing. And we started talking about it. And after that, I started telling friends. You know, I don't remember. We may have been only nude from the waist up. I don't remember that part. But whenever I tell someone, they'd sort of tip their head, like they didn't believe the University of Wisconsin-Madison would focus, would photograph girls from, you know, whether nude or the waist up. But that they would do that. And I said they called them posture pictures. Well, then when some really close friends said, "Really?" You know, like, and I came home and I looked it up on the internet, and it wasn't just, it was Eastern schools did this. And I think primarily they only did the girls. So that was sort of funny. And then there's this urban legend that
it's sort of funny. It's really not very funny at all.
It's not funny at all. But there's this urban legend, you know, that the fraternities got in Madison got some of the pictures and, you know, had a field day with them. But
you mentioned that Diane Sawyer and Hillary Clinton are among the notable women who also talk about having experienced this. And I'm sure they, like you, raise the same question. Looking back, the overriding questions loom large. Why didn't we speak up? Why didn't we tell anyone? And what were these universities thinking?
You know, it's the truth. And why didn't we tell someone? But I think it was so humiliating. That's why I don't remember completely, real specifically. I just remember standing in line, I think it was naked, with these other girls, and how humiliating it was. And we were so glad that it was over with. And I don't think we felt like telling anyone, but there are a lot of people, even when you look in the on internet, who still defend it, say, you know, we were, it was very important for people's posture, but they never did anything with us in the phi ed class about posture.
That's right.
I don't remember ever seeing the picture again.
right or I mean, what, how were these useful in what kind of meaningful way were they utilized ever? It's just amazing. And of course, then you write, "And so it is now also in about even more important issues. Our voices make a difference. The easiest thing to do in controversy is to stay silent about the wrongs of the world and to go about as if they aren't happening. It is a good way to stay out of trouble and remain in calm waters, yet that choice makes the waters more turbulent for those who come after us." Such a great, you expressed that so very, very well, that the what might feel like the easiest choice in the moment is not only a bad choice for you yourself, but a really bad choice for those that come after, because you're in a sense leaving a legacy in place that should not be there.
And as you point out, it's not just something like that incident. It's the life all around us. We really need to talk to our kids, our grandkids, about the things we went through. And, you know, like Eisenhower said at the Holocaust Memorial, he said, you know, I want this all documented so that if someday people say this isn't true, and it's the same thing in a way on a much lesser scale. But if everybody had spoken out at that time, you know, young women like me who said, "My gosh, they can't photograph us.
This is crazy.
This is crazy."
Right.
But we didn't. We sort of, I think it was different times. I think the Vietnam War had not happened yet, and there was not so much question. I mean, it was happening, actually, at that time, but it wasn't. The protests weren't so loud. It was my freshman year.
So in other words, the notion of being a protester just in period was sort of a very alien notion probably to most of you.
And for our listeners, one of my favorite in the book is Turtles Burps. It was supposed to be, it came out bumps in the book. I think it's the only two mistakes in the book, and that's one was supposed to be burps, and I didn't catch it. But Turtles Burps and Protests, because Time Magazine did the Protester of the Year, and I like that column a lot.
Absolutely.
The value of protesting.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Linda Fleshinsky, and of course, most of the time when you hear Linda Fleshinsky over the air of WGTD, she's asking the questions. Today she's answering the questions. We're talking with her about this really wonderful collection of some of her finest essays and columns called In What Light There Is. Linda, we whip right past your childhood, and I want to give you at least a minute or two to talk about each of your parents, because that's actually how the book opens with, first of all, a lovely column about your father, and then one right after that about your mother. Let's talk about your mother first, if you don't mind, because one of the things you say in this column about your mother is that she had certain... Well, first of all, you said she was the first activist you ever encountered.
Absolutely.
So that folds nicely into what we were just talking about. But this is what I remember so vividly. My mother is gone almost a decade now. She was a bright and strong woman at a time when brightness and strength were not necessarily the most desired traits in women. But strong she was, and passionate about the issues in our country and in our world. Tell us more about this aspect of your mother.
Mm-hmm. My mother really was a pacifist, and it doesn't mean that she would say we should never, ever go to war. But she was in a family of 10, grew up in a family of 10, and their precious youngest sibling, my Uncle Don, who, of course, I wasn't even born yet, but he died in World War II. And it was just... such a grieving for that family. And I think it made her see he was part of something where they just sent them to 6 weeks basic, and then these guys went out in a cordon, in a line, and they were just shot down. They were just shot, all the guys that were there that day, and then another. Just mowed down. And it was so heartbreaking for them. But I think a lot of us think that this buildup of the military, it almost leads to wars in itself, because you have all this equipment, you have all this war stuff. It's be like giving a child a room full of toys and telling them not to play with them, you know. I think we just go too easily into wars, and I got that from my mother. And I wrote in this, too, that what was so interesting is when my mother passed away, my father had already passed away, a young couple came and looked at the house, and they just fell in love with this big white house in Madison on what turned into be kind of a busy street. But so we drove past it about a year later, and here's an anti-war sign for the Iraq War at the time, right in front of the house. And we just thought, my sister said, Mom is smiling down. But she was the first one that I heard protest the Vietnam War. Now, granted, I wasn't necessarily watching the news. I'm sure that there were people. But she said, the country's going to pay a price for this war. And we sure did. Mm-hmm. And part of it was... the sort of shift where we went from not questioning enough to questioning everything.
Right. The column about your father has actually a very different tenor to it, and you are mostly in this column just talking about what a sweet, gentle person your father was. Not that your mother didn't have some sweetness and some gentleness to her, but... tell us what you remember most about your father, and maybe those qualities that were maybe especially important to you or influential of you.
And I'd like to note on this one, this is the first column that I did. And while it is about my father, it moves to this sort of bigger theme of too bad that the world just can't be more less critical, I think. My father was the least critical person that I ever knew. But with his family, he was just so gentle and loving. And I know that's kind of not the stereotype of maybe a typical dad, maybe more so now. But he really was. So if something went wrong, he'd say, it'll be okay. Everything's going to be okay. Don't worry. And actually, as a teenager, that kind of bothered me because I wanted him to be more angry about the war or something. He wasn't. But I have a funny story I'll tell real quick. Oh, I hope my sister doesn't mind.
I'm sure she will.
She was a beautiful woman all her life. She's just beautiful. And so her sorority, I was never in a sorority, but she was, and they put her up for the Miss Madison contest, which then becomes the Miss Wisconsin. So at the local level, she and I share the thing of having no artistic skills. We can't draw. We can't sing. We really can't sing. So when she placed, she was a semifinalist. And so for her talent, she did a reading. She did a reading. You know, do you ever hear Miss Miss America win with doing a reading? So the whole thing, I didn't know that at the time, though, but the whole thing embarrassed her. But I was in the kitchen with her, and my brother was standing there, and my father, and she said, and I said, you know, Sue, I told my friend that you were a semifinalist in the Miss Madison and how pretty you are. And she went, oh, don't tell anyone that. I am so embarrassed about it, she said. And my father went over, and he put his arm around her, and he said, don't feel so bad, Susie. We all make fools of ourselves at one time or another. And he didn't mean it. That's how sweet he was. He didn't even get it. My brother and I looked at each other, and we burst out laughing. But he was so sweet and gentle.
Right. It came from a kind place.
It came from a kind person.
Even if it didn't quite come out kindly. That's a great story. So tell us, at what point in your life writing became so important to you?
You know, I wish it had. When I was younger, my mother used to say, you should go into journalism. And, but I think what starts with writers is that we love reading. I remember, and I don't know how many people really remember this, but I remember when I looked at Dick and Jane and I could make out the words and how exciting that was for me. And then my parents would bring, well, my mom especially would bring books from the library, and I just fell in love with Caddy Woodlawn, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, The Diary of Anne Frank, and it just never stopped. And I think most people who love reading like you do, Greg, on some level, they even if they don't write, they wish they could write. That's where the phrase the great American novel comes from. We all want to write that great American novel. But
we want to give to others the pleasure that we've received from reading great stuff.
Yes, and the connectedness. You know, I have to say for the Journal Times, too, and WGTD, too, that doing this radio show, and especially writing that column for those years, it made me realize that one of the real gifts of writing is connecting with other people. In fact, on the back of the book, I put this quote that I just love, but it's from 1800, so it probably sounds antiquated, but all things to each other so connected are that thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star. I just love it.
Oh, I've never seen that before.
Thou canst not stir a flower without troubling a star. It's so beautiful. And when I'd write those columns, there wasn't one column I wrote that someone didn't connect with me about.
It made some kind of impression.
In fact, I did the one about that book, The Power or Quiet, it's called, The Power of Introverts. The subtitle is The Power of Introverts in a World That Talks Too Much. I wrote that column. It was in on a Sunday, and the next day I went to a big meeting, and so many people came up and said, I'm an introvert, or I'm an extrovert, and my wife's an introvert.
Thank you for making this okay.
So with writing, we connect to people, and that's why the last section of this book, The Loss of a Child, is important, because I think for anybody who's faced loss, it says what we go through. Our daughter died in 2012, and our younger daughter, and I, that's when I stopped writing for a bit.
Right. And I'm sure, you know, in some respects, that helped you even understand what writing had given to you, what it meant to you when you find yourself having to step away from it for a time, as you do. We'll get to that in just a moment. I actually think it would be really interesting for people to hear one of these columns in their entirety. And as you know, the part that I think would actually be a really nice one to read, in part because it's a bit lighthearted and yet makes a really important point, is a column called Dressing the Part on page 99. And it's actually the first column we read in the section of the book called Growing Older. And you really have some nice observations about this. And we should mention maybe that just ahead of this column is a photograph of your own grandmother, Grandmother Lavinia, apparently a photograph dating from right around the year 1900.
Yeah.
So
She was whatever Miss Appleton was called back then, and it's the sweetest picture. And
really
she didn't
is.
Have the easiest life, so she was my father's mother, and I think about her a lot.
Mm. So this is Dressing the Part, and this is Linda Fleshinsky reading her own writing.
I just want to say that when Greg, when we talked before this program, I said, can you think of one you'd like me to read? And he said Dressing the Part. And I was so pleased because this is one that actually some of my friends didn't like as much. And I love it particularly because the ending, I think that they saw it too much as being about how we dress, when you'll see at the end it's not about that at all.
Right.
You always wear black, an acquaintance said to me many years ago. Surprisingly, that was the first time I ever thought about it, not being much interested in clothing. I guess that's true, isn't it? I mumbled almost to myself. She went on to opine as if she had given this some prior thought. I think it's probably because so many of your teachers wore black in elementary school. I didn't agree, but I made no response. Being one who lives in a world of my own invented theories, I couldn't blame her for coming up with her own. And it is true that, especially when I'm at a meeting or a presentation or a party, I do tend to come to the event dressed in one of my many black dresses, which I've collected through the machinations of my life. I've noticed through the years that I'm not the only one who gravitates toward black clothing. Newscaster Rachel Maddow, whom I greatly admire, is almost always in black. And I learned from a historical reenactor that Susan B. Anthony was seen just about exclusively in black, except when she diverged with a red cape or red jackets. And, of course, there was Johnny Cash, the man in black. Since there is an entire chain of clothing stores called Black and White, we must be a dedicated but considerable tribe. It's an interesting phenomenon, this tendency toward black. Is it a trend to the dramatic that makes us choose black? Is it our shyness and a wish not to stand out? Or is it just simpler to have black clothing that you can wear with colored scarves or ties? I don't know, but I like the first reason the best, for Susan B. Anthony was certainly someone dramatic who fought uphill battles for challenging causes. We all hope that at various times in our lives we have done the same. She is good company to be among. I rarely shop for clothes these days. In retirement, I'm mostly in jeans and tops, black, of course, and I still have a closet full of good clothes from my days of work in a professional environment. Now, on those few occasions like today when I do go shopping, I lecture myself silently before I leave home, just as I did on this day. You will not buy a black dress. You will think color, maybe red, maybe green, maybe blue. You will not buy black. The scolding rarely works. And so today, as I stood in the store, my eyes gravitated to something I really liked. What a cute dress, I thought to myself as I walked toward the rack. Then I realized what it was, a black dress, another black dress. But it was so cute. Growing older, they say, is not for the faint of heart. I understand the wisdom of that more and more as the years go by. There is so much that's difficult about it. Aching joints you never knew you had, a mind that forgets things it shouldn't, and eyes that don't see as clearly as they once did. Although some of that is a blessing, the poignant irony of your visioning weakening just as the wrinkles begin to line your face. Yet for all of the negatives of growing old, and there are many, there are gifts as well. One of the best, I think, is that we know ourselves better. We look back and we see things more clearly. We see our mistakes and our successes, and we realize how hard we have been trying all along. We're more comfortable with who we are and where we've been. And we understand that while we did not accomplish all that we wanted to, we didn't do too badly either. It's been a good journey. And so that ultimate gift of aging, that gift of finally knowing who we are, comes in handy as time passes. We comprehend the beauty of a strong friendship. We marvel in the younger generation moving forward with hope and promise and the future in their faces. And we know, with a gentle self-acceptance, that we are who we are, idiosyncrasies and all. And so today I glanced at the clothing rack once again and went back to get that black dress after all. It suits me just fine.
Mm. I like that so much.
I like it too, Greg. A lot of people, that wasn't their favorite.
That's
so that
right. Well,
fun.
I think you need a new circle of friends because they obviously are not as perceptive as you and I. We're speaking today on The Morning Show with Linda Fleshinsky, talking about her book, In What Light There Is. This is a really nice collection of essays and columns. And are we talking about basically all columns that appeared in the Journal Times at one point or another?
I don't think they're all in here. And in fact, the black dress one, I thought about and I sent it to the editor, and but I sent her two, and she chose the other one. And I never did put that one in the paper. And like I said, I do like it.
Mm. There are some serious themes in the book, and one of them is you talk a lot about growing older.
Mm-hmm.
And approaching the end of life, and one theme that recurs repeatedly is fear of not so much physical deterioration, but a decline in maybe mental and emotional acuity. And this is obviously, and you write about it, this is something that you have seen yourself, as of course most people have. Can you talk more about that and the way in which you try to live with that very real possibility? That's a very real possibility for all of us.
Mm-hmm. Alzheimer's is a terribly frightening thing. I love the book Still Alice. I went and saw the movie too.
Hmm.
Not my grandma Lavinia, but my other grandmother. You know, she had 10 children, and after the birth of the 10th child, her husband died. He was a tailor. He worked long, long hours, and he died, and here she was with these 10 children. So all of her kids talk about how strong and bright and wonderful she was for all of them. And fortunately, it was the Depression, so the older kids who could work, who got some jobs, were able to pay her rent, and they survived. But what I remember of her is someone who looked really confused and lost, and I don't remember her well. Whereas my other grandma I laughed with, and we didn't see either one or the other more. But then one day, going through the photo albums, I saw a picture of her, and she was standing in the kitchen, sort of listlessly holding this towel. And she looked, if you just looked at that picture and you didn't know anything, you'd say this is someone who doesn't know where she is. And her children were there, but that's what it looked like. And to me, it seemed that way. Now, I mentioned that to my mom when she was still alive. And she said, and she went into this, how wonderful she was. But we're scared about Alzheimer's. And I think as we get older and we forget things, it's frightening. Especially, I think, when we forget the names of people who we should know. You know, when I was on school board, when I worked for the school district, there were people who came in and sat in my office and talked to me. And so they knew me well because I was the director of communication, or I was the school board member.
A very public figure.
Yeah, but I met them once. So, but still, sometimes I think, but we talked, I should remember, and it's scary to me because
yeah.
I think she had a kind of Alzheimer's.
Absolutely. And this is a portion of a column called Mistakes in Genetics, where you're kind of talking about when we make these momentary mistakes sometimes, and we wonder what we are, what we might be confronting, and is this the start of something really dark and frightening? Here is the fate that I and others fear is in our genes. We've seen it, and it terrifies us, makes our blood go cold. We don't want our children struggling with us at a stage when they need to introduce us to people we've known for years. We don't want them burdened, nor do we want to be burdened with final years like that. It is too painful. You go on to say, I know one thing. I have seen the fate of my grandmother and my aunts, and it isn't a fate I choose. I will watch, be diligent, and hope that I have choices before my mind takes the possibility of choice away.
Mm-hmm.
I've never stopped to think about that mental decline that we're talking about, that's one of the things that, in a sense, happens, is that you lose the capacity to, first of all, make wise choices for yourself, and in some cases, make any choices whatsoever about yourself. And that's so intrinsically part of what makes us human.
Absolutely. And you know how frightening for all of us to think of a time when we won't know our children. We saw a man, a professor, university professor, who we knew well, get to the point where the only person he knew was his wife, and he didn't know where he was. In all the years he spent at the university, he didn't remember. He just didn't remember things that he should have. So it's very frightening for us. I mean, I keep hearing that they're doing genetic research and they're close, and I'm thinking I'm in my late 60s. In fairness to my aunts, though, I have to say they were late 80s or early 90s before they got it, and up to then they were awfully good functioning. So, I mean, in a way, maybe if we all live long enough, if they don't find a way to cure this. And it would be a big step, you know, to be at a point where you'd say, well, I'd rather die than face the future I'm facing. And so I don't know that, you know, that's actually really a choice, but it's something we think about. It's scary.
Yeah, it poses very, very powerful, inescapable questions about what is most important. The final portion of the book deals with the hardest of the various losses that you have experienced in your life, and this is the tragic death of your daughter Jocelyn. I should mention that actually the day we are interviewing this is the day after the second or third anniversary of her death. I think what would be interesting for us to just talk about for a moment, if you're comfortable, is because we've talked so much about, you know, you as a writer and this and that, what this did for you in terms of your powers of expression, your means of expression, all the words of wisdom you had, in a sense, bestowed, and in all of the writing that you had done, the sense I get from writing this that the previous losses in your life did not begin to prepare you for what this kind of loss meant and was to you.
Absolutely, Greg. How it's nice of you to bring it up, and the way you just said that is perfect. Nothing can prepare you for a sudden death of someone that you love so dearly, and someone who was really remarkable. When Robin Williams died last year, I wrote a column that was in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about how we face sudden death and how we face loss, and, you know, the courage to talk about mental health issues. Sometimes when people die, you know, everyone eulogizes them. But I'll tell you, our daughter, she was a remarkable person. And I got together with the boys yesterday, adults in Milwaukee, and we got together and had a dinner together, and we talked about her. And my older daughter in Salt Lake City, she called too, and we talked. She was very sweet. Very, very sweet. And maybe that was part of her downfall. She was very sensitive to pain and hurt. But she was living a wonderful life. She had her own home. She worked as a therapist with autistic children. But the funny thing, and everybody who wrote about her, everybody, and it was tons of people. I didn't know she interacted in her work with that many people. Families of autistic kids said, one person said, when Jocelyn came in the house and she walked right straight to my son and put her hand on his, she became a part of our family, and she always will be. And but the one thing, I back to what I was saying, she is, what they really talked about her was how much she smiles and laughed. She had the most beautiful smile in the world. So it's kind of ironic, I guess, that she found life difficult. But I just think we're all broken in some ways, and back to what it's done to me as far as writing. I did stop writing then, and I thought I couldn't write anymore. And sometimes it's harder for me to write because the things that I write about are like gratitude. I have from my father, I think, this overwhelming sense of, you know, I'd pull into our yard and think, I'm so lucky to live here. I'd have the kids together and think, I'm so lucky. And some of that is diminished because I'm not so lucky now. I would trade everything.
Right.
For, you know, yeah, to have her back.
Right. And it probably feels strange to feel gratitude or to express gratitude, and yet in some ways you probably feel even more grateful for some of those things that remain in your life.
And you have to move that gratitude to, which I've done pretty successfully, is move it to, I'm so grateful that we had her for 32 years of her life. I'm so grateful for that, and so grateful for what remains. So you do that, but I could, some of the essays I wrote in this book, I've spent forever trying to write a preface to explain how some of the essays in this book I could not have written now, because they were full of more, maybe a little more joy in places. And
when you could not write, are you conscious of what was going on? Was it just that there was so much sorrow that there was no room for anything else? Or, I mean, were you at all moved to even sit down and try to write? Or was the thought, did it not even cross your mind for the longest time to even try to write or want to write?
I think it's true that I was very wounded, and I think that made it difficult to write. But I thought I actually couldn't write anymore. And the interesting thing is that the last section of this book, The Loss of a Child, those are five of my favorite essays, and I wrote those after she died. So I can still write, but somehow there's a little more strain of sorrow or sadness in
sure.
it.
I so appreciated the column in which you talk about encountering someone that you call Marcy. That's not her real name, but somebody you bumped into in the store, and somebody recognized you. Didn't she write a column for the newspaper, and you nodded, and she said, "I miss it," she said with a gentleness. "Each Sunday I open the paper up, hoping it will be there. Could you start writing it again?"
And I remember that day so specifically, being in a store and someone I don't know came up and said that to me, and she told me she keeps her favorite column of mine in her nightstand. And, you know, it is overwhelming. And I talked about one of the things about being a writer that's glorious, and probably like you doing the beautiful music you do in your show, you hear from people, and it's so gratifying. It's like, I don't know, it's you've really connected with other people, and you see my writing, my sitting there and doing this makes a difference.
Well, and in particular, in the lives of strangers.
Yes.
To me, that's the, like, when I write a song that somebody I don't even know turns out loves that song, but the fact that it's not my Aunt Hazel or one of my own students, but it's some person I otherwise would never know, and in fact don't know except for this one connection
Absolutely.
We have.
Absolutely. I wanted to say one more thing, too, about the writing process, because you said, you know, how did it write easily or not? This napping column, to me, is the funniest story, because I had a column due in 5 days. It's so good to have a column because you have a deadline. You've got to get something done. So I was talking to a friend on the phone who runs this big nonprofit thing, and she said, "Write about naps. They are so underrated." And I hung up the phone, and that thing just almost wrote itself. Now, if you said to me, could I write a 2-page essay about naps, I think, well, no. And the funniest things just come out of you sometimes, and then there are other times that you struggle. So I start with an Andy Rooney quote where somebody asks him, "When you write a column, how long does it take?" He says, "Oh, the good ones write themselves in an hour." And he said, "The bad ones take weeks." Isn't that funny? So I started with that, and then I ended the column, "Well, you know, this one went pretty fast, so maybe that means it's a good column, or maybe it just means I need a nap."
But I really agree with what you say when you say that an hour sleeping on the couch soundly in the afternoon beats a whole night of sleep in your bed.
I don't know what there is about that, but boy, it's so deep and special.
Right, and now that you are retired, that's one of the things you get to enjoy. Well, we're just about out of time. Do you have a parting thought for us?
If I could say real quickly two parting thoughts. One is the last writing in the book is called Reincarnation. It's in Loss of a Child. And I like it very much. It's probably one of my favorites, because what it says to us is that it's about a friend of mine who goes out to the desert. Her life is not what she's not in a good point in her life. And she decides to take a trip all by herself and to go to the desert. And she didn't know why. And she went in the spring of the year, and of course, instead of it being all dry and barren, it's just exploding with colors because the cacti are all blooming. And, you know, the point kind of the story is that we can get through the winters of our lives, and I need that message myself so badly that I think that's why I wrote it. I think I need to believe that I can get through the winters of my life, and I have a lot to get through. So, and the second thing I just wanted to say real quickly is, if you're thinking about writing, or if you've written something you really like and you You want to get it published. You know, you can go through the process, which takes a long time of submissions and rejections. But there are independent publishing platforms, which is what I used. I used createspace.com. And if anyone out there wants to do this, as I did, more for legacy than for making money or just for legacy, so it'd be there for my kids, my grandkids, and readers who might have liked my column, try it, createspace.com or other independent
publishing. Very good.
Values.
In the meantime, this book, which I really urge people to take in hand because we just scratched the surface of it, is In What Light There Is. And I know it's available in a number of different locations around.
The easiest way to get it is to probably go to the Racine Heritage Museum.